Staring at the bodies of his daughter and her three children, Hassan bid farewell to his daughter while he was at work trying to pull their bodies from the rubble.
I was at work when Mohammed called me to tell that Israel bombed his house and my daughter and her three kids were under the rubble. They weren't ambulances. They were all out on missions and I had to wait for them. When I got to them, their bodies were all out of the rubble. I don't know why Israel targeted them.
Most Gazans are in need of mental health support following the latest 11-day escalation that killed families in their homes in Gaza. The north parts of the Gaza Strip, along with Beit Hanun and Jabalia, was one of the areas that witnessed bombardment coupled with heavy artillery shelling. Hundreds of Palestinians, including women and children, were killed in the Israeli bombardment of the Gaza Strip in 11 days of the conflict that began on May 10. Israel's airstrikes also brought widespread devastation to the already impoverished territory.
Palestinians here say the aggression has not undermined their will to stand against the occupation regime. They say despite their suffering, they will remain steadfast and fight for their rights. Ruba Shabet, Gaza.
Against the racist and Islamophobic far right, in defense of public and individual liberties, that's the main slogan of 140 marches that took place all over France, organized by more than 100 organizations and associations. The protesters say there is an urgency to stop the rise of far right militias and parties in France that act more and more openly and in full impunity.
It's the first time that we see people producing videos with death threats and using real bullets in a killing setup. We didn't realize the nature of a danger that's rising in our country. The day after the video, the president of the republic's been slapped in the face. I think that now many people are aware of the gravity of the situation.
Earlier this year, thousands of militaries, amongst them dozens of generals, openly called for law and order against the danger of Islamization of the French society. Earlier this week, a known far-right activist posted a video where he stabs with a knife and shoots with real bullets a puppet representing progressive activists and calling for the murder of journalists and the left leader Mélenchon. One day later, a far-right activist slapped President Macron in the face, shouting a royalist slogan. But instead of facing a danger of a fascist putsch, the French government was occupied in endless debates in Parliament and Senate about separatism targeting directly the Muslim community or in voting laws protecting the police.
The French government should be a barrier, but step by step it is becoming a bridge to the far right because the government is introducing in the public debate topics like migration and so-called separatism. There is clearly an authoritarian drift of the government, and all these issues pave the way for the far right.
The far right tries to introduce in France as a unique issue the Muslims and the insecurity. These are not the problems that we face. We face social and health problems. These are the real problems.
Protesters say that an authoritarian and racist drift in the French society is already taking place. This ideology is officially carried by the Marine Le Pen party. Instead of facing this danger, they say the French government is copying parts of the far-right program and is not making any concessions to the popular movement like the Yellow Vest protests. Presidential elections will take place in France in less than 1 year, and the odds of a racist and Islamophobic far-right leader taking the reins remain high. Christian Hunt, Paris.
For the last time, the seven presidential candidates stood toe-to-toe at the headquarters of Iran's national television, the IRIB, to face off for the third and final debate. While the debate was themed with people's concerns, it was derailed every once in a while toward other issues, such as foreign policy, a topic toward which the two camps of the principalists and the reformists have conflicting stances. The debate saw the two pro-reformist candidates, Abdel Nasser Himati and Mohsen Mehranizadeh, stressing the need for Iran to join the Paris-based Financial Action Task Force, or the FATF, a global intergovernmental organization tasked with combating money laundering and terrorism financing. Iran and North Korea are the only two countries in the world that have not signed up for the FATF.
Mr. Jalili, only you and North Korea are saying that the FATF is useless. Are you saying the 200 countries around the world which signed the FATF do not understand that it's useful or not? The FATF is meant to contain money laundering and terrorism. Please think twice before making any comment.
Saeed Jalili, a heavyweight principalist, called Iran's entrance into the FATF an irreparable mistake that completes the puzzle of sanctions by the West and the U.S.
Entering into some international conventions is a mistake. You agree to enter into the FATF, but then they will decide the next step for you.
But he did not elaborate on his stance during the debate. Along with other journalists, I waited outside the debate studio to investigate his take on the FATF and how he would treat the international convention, should he become the next Iranian president.
The Iranian government has already signed an action plan with the FATF. Rouhani has agreed that Iran implement 39 out of the 41 articles of the FATF. Iran did comply with those 39 articles, yet that organization has approved only 16 of them. Furthermore, the FATF has made an announcement that if Iran fulfills the entire 41 articles, still it would define the next step for the country. Iranians need to know about these facts.
As part of Iran's action plan with the FATF, initially agreed upon more than 6 years ago, the country had to finalize four pieces of legislation. Two were passed by a reformist-dominated parliament, but the incumbent principalist-heavy parliament has halted the approval of the two remaining bills and referred them to the arbitration body, the Expediency Council, whose secretary is another presidential runner, Mohsen Rezai. Rezai says any decision regarding the FATF now is tied to whether the U.S. would lift its anti-Iran sanctions as part of the ongoing Vienna talks between Iran and the parties to the nuclear deal over the revival of the 2015 accord. This is how the upcoming presidential election could shape Iran's foreign policy. Iranians will go to polls on June 18th to choose their next president.
While many Iranians are still undecided on a single candidate, the debates have helped them to narrow down their choices. But the question of who will be the next Iranian president will be answered on June 18th. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
To mark the 2,000 days of the detention of Sheikh Zazaki, the Islamic movement in Nigeria issued a statement expressing concern over the continuous detention of the Islamic cleric, but most especially the silence of other Nigerians over this injustice. In December 2015, Sheikh Zazaki was arrested by security forces following an attack on his home and worship center, where hundreds of his supporters were killed by soldiers. The statement by the Islamic movement said the silence of those who supposed to condemn the injustice is more painful than the jubilation of the oppressors.
The masses should know that if today is Sheikh Zazaki, tomorrow it may be you. If you are a Christian and the government is detaining the Sheikh, well, you want to kill the Sheikh because he doesn't practice the same ideology in Islam with them, what about you that you are a Christian? You should come out and join hand and fight against injustice and say no to injustice and oppression.
For over 5 years, members of the Islamic movement have been coming out to protest, seeking for the release of Sheikh Zazaki, but the Nigerian government has kept a deaf ear. Over 300 supporters of Sheikh Zazaki were killed and dumped in a mass grave without proper identification and funeral prayers. This and the attack on Sheikh Zazaki and his supporters, according to the Islamic movement, were despicable and unacceptable.
That is the worst that has happened in the history of Africa, where a detachment of army of a country, we launch an attack to an innocent citizen, to his house, is the worst crime against humanity in the history of Africa.
Sheikh Ibrahim al-Zazaki is spending close to 6 years in detention. The Islamic movement in Nigeria called on the Nigerian authorities to comply with the Federal High Court order and release Sheikh Zazaki and his wife Zainab. Tanjim Abdullahi, Abuja.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Rather than truthfully reporting on Israeli regime's actions, German journalists and politicians obsess over anti-Semitism by attacking immigrant communities at home, says Matt Unicom, journalist, in an article titled How Germany Ignores Israeli Regime's War Crimes. Stay tuned for more. On May 15th, around 3,000 students, activists, and local Arabs gathered in Berlin's Nuklon neighborhood for a rally in support of Palestine liberation. The atmosphere was overwhelmingly peaceful for most of the afternoon, as couples wearing keffiyehs maneuvered small children between teenagers wrapped in Palestinian flags. Demonstrators waved signs in English, German, and Arabic as they made their way down Sunanli, the beating heart of Berlin's Arab quarter. By the time police violently dispersed the rally, citing a lack of social distancing, newsrooms throughout Germany had already decided on the narrative they would push. It was anti-Semitic agitation, declared RBB, Berlin's state-funded broadcaster. An article on the website of Tagesschau, Germany's most watched evening news program, referred to anti-Semitic protest, while the right-wing Bild announced police injured at hate demo. No major media outlet ran interviews with demonstrators during or in the days after this protest. Instead, there were sound bites from police and senior politicians condemning those who attended, especially those with Arab backgrounds. "Anyone who wants to live here permanently must commit to freedom and democracy," Berlin State Minister of the Interior Andreas Gesell told Radio Eins. Before long, conservative politician Alexander Dobrindt had said that asylum seekers who attended pro-Palestine rallies should be deported. Even Die Linke, the most left-wing of Germany's six major parties, joined in, saying, "If we are being honest, we must admit it, we have imported anti-Semitism," read a post from the party's Osnabrück Land District office. Other members distanced themselves from the post. In Germany, any pro-Palestine position, especially from immigrants or left-wing activists, is dangerous. This is the view championed by journalists who are unable or unwilling to differentiate between anti-Semitism, anti-Zionism, and support for Palestine. The result is a degraded discourse that empowers racism. Its other victims are logic and balanced reporting. Blaming immigrants for anti-Semitism is all too easy for a political system and media described as blind in its right eye, oblivious towards the far right and vicious towards the left. More pro-Palestinian demonstrations took place in Berlin in the days and weeks after the Nuklon protest. All the protests in Berlin were peaceful, but that didn't stop Bild from reporting on Israeli hate at what he called at a youth demonstration in central Berlin's Potsdamer Platz, where teenagers laid still on the ground to symbolize the Palestinian children killed by the Israeli regime airstrikes. RBB, meanwhile, took down and apologized for a live TV report describing the atmosphere at one Alexanderplatz demonstration as very good. Intense criticism from left and right, including from the right-wing paper Welt, forced RBB to remove the video from its website and apologize for a report that didn't meet its journalistic standards. Palestinian-American journalist and activist Ali Abunima found out what happens to voices that contradict the dominant narrative when he told a Deutsche Welle anchor that Palestinian children were sick of paying the price for guilty German conscience. In the days following Abu Nima's interview, Deutsche Welle, Germany's multilingual international-facing public broadcaster, apologized for what they claimed was anti-Semitic content and sent a memo to staff reminding them to not use terms like colonization and apartheid when mentioning Israel. "This mistake should not have happened," Deutsche Welle said. Sound familiar? Reporting on the actual violence across Palestine was similarly one-sided. The Frankfurter Allgemeine on May 12th said, more than 1,000 rockets fired at Israel. Terror against Israel, reported Tagesspiegel. Why Deutsche Welle celebrated with headlines such as Israel's Iron Dome proved successful against Gaza rockets and Germany stands by Israel. It was almost impossible to find stories drawing attention to the more than 200 civilians killed by the Zionist regime airstrikes. Even the New York Times, which days earlier ran a full page and condemning pro-Palestinian celebrities, mourned the conflict's child victims with a front page cover. In Germany, there were outrageous examples to the contrary. Two Deutsche Welle journalists attempt some investigative journalism by fact-checking the authenticity of the so-called viral post of dead Arab children shared on social media. They ask whether images of dead kids and bombed-out buildings were in fact recently taken in Gaza, or were they from an earlier Israeli bombing campaign? Germany leads try to ignore Palestine by producing inaccurate reporting and their unquestionable support for the Israeli regime war crimes. Politicians and journalists who willingly conflate anti-Semitism with the pro-Palestine movement are denying basic truth to German citizens. The world is full of grandstanding politicians, and Germany is no exception. But in Germany, more than anywhere else in Europe or North America, they are emboldened by a media landscape that lacks the nuance to properly report on one of the most crucial moral issues of our time. As in any democracy, the media's role should be to question the government's narratives, not to parrot attacks from politicians who scapegoat some of society's most vulnerable.
The debate.
Hello and a warm welcome to the debate. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. Israeli far-right groups have marched in the occupied East Jerusalem al-Quds. Palestinian protesters have also gathered at the venue of the so-called March of the Flags, which marks the anniversary of Israel's 1967 occupation of the city's eastern sector. Tel Aviv's annexation of East Jerusalem al-Quds during the six-day 1967 war has never been recognized by most of the international community. Israeli forces have cordoned off roads leading to Damascus Gate in the city and arrested a number of Palestinians on the steps of the gate leading to the old city. Now, is this supposed to end up in violence? Stay tuned to Press TV and watch us discuss aspects of the issue with our experts. Let's get an update first. Let's go to Akiba Ramallah. Mona Candle is there. Mona, over to you. What's going on there?
Well, despite the metal barriers that were erected by the Israeli police in Jerusalem, Al-Quds Old Town, and in the streets leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the Damascus Gate, Bab al-Amud, however, Palestinians, thousands of them, succeeded to reach Bab al-Amud area, the Damascus Gate, and demonstrated their protested in order to prevent thousands of Israeli settlers who were taking part in Jerusalem flag march. Clashes erupted between the Israeli police who were protecting the settlers. According to paramedics, 33 Palestinians were wounded by the Israeli forces. 17 others were detained by the Israeli soldiers during the clashes that erupted in the Bab al-Amoud area. Palestinians sent a clear message that even the Jerusalem flag march, and despite the strict measures, and we are speaking about over 2,000 more Israeli police officers that were deployed in the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and around the Al-Aqsa Mosque in order to protect the settlers' march. However, Palestinians succeeded to reach there and to send a clear message that Jerusalem, Al-Quds, will always be a Palestinian, and that Al-Aqsa Mosque is Islamic, and they will continue to defend it. Israeli forces closed Arab and Palestinian shops in the old town. The streets that around the Al-Aqsa Mosque, like Al-Misrara, Bab al-Sahira, as well as Sultan streets, were completely closed by the Israeli soldiers. The route of the march changed a lot by the Israeli forces. However, the Israeli settlers did not enter the old town of Jerusalem, Al-Quds, and the gate of Bab al-Amoud was completely closed. The settlers didn't enter the Bab al-Amoud gate in order to enter to the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. However, they marched and celebrated and sang and danced in the complex of Bab al-Amoud. However, Palestinians, elderly women, youths were there to confront them despite the strict measures and despite the attack by the Israeli forces who were protecting the settlers. Experts said that that was a challenge for the new Israeli coalition cabinet in case they, for the last moment, they were expecting that the Israeli cabinet would end this protest or would change completely the route of this march, especially after the warnings from the Hamas movement that sent a warning to the Israeli cabinet that if the settlers enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, they would bear the consequences.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Mona Khan in Ramallah. Now, joining me in this debate tonight will be Palestinian activist Amal Watan in Ramallah and also professor of media practice and philosophy with Coventry University, Kenneth Poe in London. Good to have you both on the show. Let's go to Akibai Ramallah. Amal, what does this day back in 1967 remind the Palestinians about?
Yes, in 1967, of course, the Israeli occupation occupied the rest of Palestine, West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. And for them, in this Jerusalem Day march, they're trying to show off that they were able to unify Jerusalem under the control of the Israeli occupation. And for us Palestinians, it was a Nakba at that time, Nakba in 1948, and it's continued. This Nakba is continuing until now, while the Israeli occupation still seizing our land and killing our people and seizing Gaza. So the Nakba for us continues, and this march today and the show of illusional victory, let's say, that they were able to go on with their flag parade shows that they have been defeated, because Jerusalem has turned into a military barracks. 20,000 soldiers and policemen were spread in Jaffa Gate and in the streets leading to the old city of Jerusalem. The old city of Jerusalem has turned also into military barracks. They closed all shops, Palestinian shops, and they forced the owners to go to their homes. So the whole city was turned into curfew for the Palestinians, but it was full of soldiers. The marchers themselves, they counted for 22 or 3,000, but the rest of them were Israeli policemen and soldiers. So this show of force shows that the Israelis were defeated today as well, because the Palestinians were demonstrating in all streets leading to the old city of Jerusalem, and
that's
there
right.
were as well confrontations in several areas. So they think that they succeeded in this flag parade, but at the same time, the Palestinians showed their will as well.
All right, now let me ask Professor Farrow, is this the right time for the Israelis to hold such a controversial rally? It's only weeks since a truce to stop the Israeli deadly aggression on Palestinian lands.
Well, I think, as we've seen before, there's a pattern of provocation in situations like this, and that's part of the way that the Israelis have handled the situation externally. We've heard about the military suppression internally. But of course, Israel depends on its position in terms of the international reflection of the actions that it takes. And so it has considered this, and it's allowed this to go ahead. It's created the situation. We have to, of course, repeat the fact that Israel is a settler state. It's a violent occupation. And Palestinians have suffered violence since 1948, and that violence is physical, mental, cultural, and economic. And actions like today, and incidents like today, act towards a kind of humiliation, an attempt to humiliation of the Palestinians. And we know that since 1948, there has been resistance and always been a fight for the right of return. So when people take a position, when Palestinians take a position against Israeli aggressions, every time they do that, they're part of a long history of resistance to occupation. Now, there's always been a political battle for Palestine in the international world, and this is about ideas, about representation, rhetoric, and images. These are all issues. But I think what's happened recently, there's been a shift, there's been a change in favor of Palestine and the Palestinians. And I think this has happened because there was a shift around the notion of Israel as an apartheid state, which has been happening over the past 10 to 15 years. We had the boycotts of Israeli goods, and the notion that Israel and South Africa are similar entities. And this is something which has gained a kind of traction internationally. We know that in every situation, there's always a battle for the hearts and minds of people, mm-hmm. and media is a very, very important part of that. We saw this in Vietnam, for example, where the Americans, we know, lost the war. And I think there is that kind of feeling at the moment, particularly in young people, who all of a sudden have suddenly gained an interest in Palestine. And we've seen it internationally across the world. The TikTok generation are really completely involved and interested in the situation of Palestine. And this is something which is reaching millions and millions of people, over 300 million people on TikTok talking about Palestine, debating Palestine, and showing concern for Palestine. And I think so whatever happens on the ground in Al-Quds or in Gaza or in the rest of the occupied territories, in Palestine as a whole, is feeding into a much bigger debate, and that debate is really quite radical compared to what we've had over recent years. Okay. Young people are saying that they don't believe in the Oslo Accord, that the Oslo Accord is dead. They're not even believing in the two-state solution. And I think this is a great shift in recent political kind of debates that we've seen, which the media is very importantly feeding into, and of course that's why Palestinian media is being suppressed today by Israeli authorities. We know that there's been a huge clampdown because they do not want images of suppression to be beamed across the world, because they know that's a losing battle.
Okay. Now, Amal, the new government in Tel Aviv has lent full back into the holding of the March of Flags in this sensitive juncture. It seems that a new prime minister doesn't care much about how the Palestinians feel about this occasion. Let's have your take.
Of course, both governments, the former and the current government, they don't care. They come actually from the same roots. They're both ultra-Zionist, ultra-racist, Nazis. So both government leaders of the former and the current governments are extremists. So they don't give or they don't care about Palestinian lives. They don't care. The only notion that they care about is the Zionist ideology, which is seizing the whole lands of the Palestinians. And that's what we are currently going through inside Jerusalem and the surrounding neighborhoods of Jerusalem, like Sheikh Jarrah and Silwan neighborhoods, seizing more and more houses and ordering demolishing of houses, of more houses. 638 houses are to be demolished in Silwan. This is ethnic cleansing. So the policy of ethnic cleansing continues since 1948 up until now. Now the Palestinians own only 10% to 12% of their land, while the Israelis are seizing most of the land. It is an apartheid state, and world opinion has changed gradually until last month, when they were more convinced that this apartheid state has to be stopped, has to be dismantled. If we want to reach peace and security and prosperity in this region and for the whole world as well, this apartheid state must be dismantled, and a new state should be, one democratic state should be established on its places where we can have a normal life in this region. This apartheid state actually poses a threat to the whole region and internationally as well. We can see that they are outreach as Africa or Eastern Europe. So the ramification of the existence of this colonial apartheid regime in this area is causing danger to the whole world.
Right.
Nonetheless, the region and Palestinians as well.
Okay. Kenneth, you know that Tel Aviv has put the air defense batteries on high alert and fearing rocket fire from the Palestinian side. Do you expect an escalation? And if that happens, how violent would it be this time around?
Well, I think the violence is there. The violence has never gone away. We can't really talk about escalation because on a daily basis, Palestinians are suffering and they're dying. And so in the way the framing of this in the media, particularly in some elements of the Western media, is as if these are just small explosions that happen and it's just a matter of getting the two sides together. That depiction is an entire lie. It's been a lie since 1948 and it's never stopped. And I think we have to get away from this notion that, you know, it's just a question of something happens and then there's a reaction and then another reaction. This has to be part of the analysis of the situation, the analysis of the creation of the state of Israel as an apartheid state, the function of its state, how it works internationally, how it relates economically to the United States. This is what we need to consider. Because if we're constantly going to be dealing with day-to-day aggressions and reactions, and whether that reaction is internal to Palestine, whether that's international, we're never going to move away from a circle of discussions and discussions. And I think that the shift towards the recognition by governments now who are beginning to listen to their people, you know, things only change when people move. That's the history of the world. Mm-hmm. And what we've seen recently in terms of the issue of Palestine is that there's been a move from great sections of the international community, an interest in Palestine, and a determination to support Palestine. We also have to recognize the role of refugees, Palestinian refugees, who were forced from their land violently in 1948 onwards and had to go as refugees across the world. And they've settled in those countries. And those, the children of that generation are growing up and asking questions like, why can't I go home? They're in a position of power. They may be filmmakers, they may be models, they may be scientists. They are part of those societies, whether it's in Canada, the United States, or Europe. And now they're using their power to explain to the world that they are not satisfied with what's happened. They want the right of return. Their families want the right of return. And so the debate, I think, has to be shifted away from the violence. The violence has to stop. There should be intervention. Okay. There should be international intervention in the violence which Israel is using against the Palestinians. And this is long and long overdue. We all know that the reason this has been allowed, permitted, and actually encouraged is the United States and its need to control the Middle East for its own economic purposes. Okay. So this is the bigger picture.
Okay,
and
if
I
you
think
allow me, we have only 1 minute left. Let me put the one last question to Amal. Amal, with Naftali Bennett assuming the post of prime minister in the Tel Aviv regime, would you expect to see change in the Israeli policies vis-a-vis the Palestinians? We have only 1 minute.
No, of course not. As I said, the former and current governments are the same. They were in the same party, actually. They're part of the Likud party. So nothing is going to change for us. And the fact that four elections occurred in 2 years shows a lot, shows that this whole state is descending or is in a descending phase. The internal problems that they have, even within the right-wing Zionist parties, is incredible and is affecting the rest of their own people. So the demography is working against them. Palestinians in all of Palestine, historic Palestine, are exceeding in numbers. They're uniting together. The new generation of 1948, together with the West Bank, Gaza, and Jerusalem, are in one but fighting and resisting this okay. occupation in all means. The resistance in Gaza and the axis of resistance actually in the whole region are supporting the Palestinians. The international free people are also okay. on our side. So
unfortunately, I got to jump in. That's all the time we have. Sorry for interrupting you.
The course of history is very...
Okay, and that's with that we should... I should appreciate the contribution made by our guests. We had Palestinian activists Amal Wahtan and Ramallah, and professor of media practice and philosophy with Coventry University, Kenneth Ferro in London, with their contribution. I've been your host, Behrouz Najafi.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
For years, civil rights groups and academics have raised alarm at the way U.S. Republican officials have deployed false claims of voter fraud as a political strategy to justify laws that restrict access to the ballot. We're prepared for you an article written by Sam Levine under the heading, How U.S. Republicans Came to Embrace the Big Lie of a Stolen Election. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. A few days after the polls closed in Florida's 2018 general election, Rick Scott, the then state's governor, held a press conference outside the governor's mansion and made a stunning accusation. Rick Scott was running for a U.S. Senate seat, and as more votes were counted, his lead was dwindling. Targeting two of the state's most Democratic-leaning counties, Rick Scott said there was rampant fraud. Directing the state's law enforcement agency to investigate, he said, "Every person in Florida knows exactly what is happening. Their goal is to mysteriously keep finding more votes until the election turns out the way they want." He added, I will not sit idly by while unethical liberals try to steal this election from the great people of Florida. Rick Scott eventually won the election, and his comments eventually faded away. But the episode offered an alarming glimpse of the direction the Republican Party was turning. A little over 2 years later, fanned repeatedly by Donald Trump throughout 2020, the myth of a stolen American election has shifted from a fringe idea to one being embraced by the Republican Party. The so-called big lie, the idea that the election was stolen from Donald Trump, has transformed from a tactical strategy to a guiding ideology. For years, civil rights groups and academics have raised alarm at the way Republican officials have deployed false claims of voter fraud as a political strategy to justify laws that restrict access to the ballot. But they say the way Republicans have embraced the myth of a stolen election since Donald Trump's loss in last November is new, marking a dangerous turn from generalized allegations of fraud to refusing to accept the legitimacy of elections. Supporting the idea of a stolen election has become a new kind of litmus test for Republican office holders. Republican election officials in Georgia and Nevada, who have stood up for the integrity of the 2020 election results, have been denounced by their fellow Republicans. Republican lawmakers across the United States have made pilgrimages to visit and champion an unprecedented inquiry into ballots in Arizona, which experts see as a thinly veiled effort to undermine confidence in the election. 147 Republicans in the U.S. House voted to overturn the results of last November's election, absent any evidence of voter fraud, and after government officials said the 2020 election was the most secure in American history. Richard Hassan, a law professor at the University of California at Irvine, who studied election rules, said, "Voter suppression is not new. The battle lines have been drawn over that for quite some time, but this new concern about election subversion is really worrisome." The willingness to deny election results comes amid heightened concern that Republicans are maneuvering to take over offices that would empower them to block the winners of elections from being seated. Several Republicans who have embraced the idea that the election was stolen are running to serve as secretaries of state, the chief election official in many places, a perch from which they would exert enormous power over elections, including the power to hold up certifying races. Edward Foley, a law professor at The Ohio State University, who has written extensively about the history of contested elections in the United States, said, "I do think it's a relatively new phenomena, unfortunately and disturbing," adding, "We've had disputed elections in the past, but we've never had the denial of the basic mathematical reality of counting votes." The effort to undermine the election result appears to be working. According to a May Reuters Ipsos poll, a majority of Republicans and a quarter of all Americans believe Donald Trump is the true president. The same opinion poll showed 61% of Republicans believe the election was stolen from Donald Trump. Ron Bishop, the chairman of the local Republican Party in Fond du Lac County in Wisconsin, said it was damaging to have such widespread uncertainty about the result of elections and was generally supportive of efforts to restore confidence. But he noted his dismay that Republicans continue to push lies about the election. He noted that the Republican Party of Waukesha County, a bastion of GOP voters, recently hosted a screening of a film backed by Mike Lindell, a Trump ally and prominent election conspiracist that pushed false claims of election fraud. He said, "We need to win back those suburban Republican voters that Waukesha County used to turn out, not keep poking them in the eye by forcing down their throat more of this election stuff, Trump stuff they don't want to hear." He added, "I don't know why it's so hard for Republican elected officials to tell the base the truth. That would help." Alexander Kesar, a Harvard historian who studied elections, noted that there was a long history in America of using fraud as an excuse to push back on gains in enfranchisement among blacks and other minority groups. Data shows white voters are becoming a smaller share of the U.S. electorate. He said, "There are definitely echoes of this now," adding, "There has always been an inclination to see new voters of different ethnicities or appearance as agents or unwitting agents of fraud." Max Stepanovich, a longtime Republican operative in Florida who is now retired, said the lies about the election provided a kind of cover for those unable to concede they were a shrinking minority in the population. He said, "In the past, party elders, party leaders, exploited the crazies in order to win elections, and then largely ignored them after the elections." He added, "What has happened since then is that Donald Trump opened the Pandora's box and let them out. He not only let them out, he affirmed them and provoked them. And so now they're running wild and they're legitimizing these delusions." While there have been other nastily contested elections in U.S. history, President Rutherford B. Hayes was labeled Rutherfraud, and his fraudulency after the contested election in 1876, both Kesar and Foley said it was difficult to find a comparison to what was happening now. Foley added, "We've never had that. We've never had McCarthyism-style fabrication of a conspiracy theory applied to the process of counting votes. I would say it's especially dangerous when it's the electoral process." He added, "Because it's the electoral process that ultimately allows for self-government. When the mechanisms of self-government kind of get taken over by a kind of McCarthyism, that's very troubling."
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran,